This is Radio Reorient, part of Network Reorient, the podcast arm of the Critical Muslim Studies Project. We aim to explore the post-Western and reconnect the Islamosphere. We're fresh off the second International Critical Muslim Studies Conference at Leeds. It was a brilliant event with people from all over the world coming together to explore the Muslim question. I hope the conversation started there continue on and bear fruit, inshallah. Now, on to today's episode. It's the second part of a special series on the ongoing political crisis in Pakistan. But before we get more into this, much has happened since I last spoke to you, and I feel like I say this every single time an episode comes out, but events are coming at us thick and fast, it seems. One of the biggest events has been the murder of French teenager Nahal Merzouk and the subsequent fallout from this. It's been interesting to see how representatives of the Westernese world order have tried to spin this into an immigration issue. And it's also been interesting to note that the fundraiser for the officer who murdered Nahal far outstrips the one for the family of Nahal. Whiteness always protects its own. Another major event that is the subject of today's special episode is the ongoing political crisis in Pakistan. And as such, the immediate context of today's discussion remains Pakistan's subjection to a de facto military dictatorship that is waging war on its people in its bid to crush former Prime Minister Imran Khan and his party, the Pakistan Tehreek-e-Insaf, or PTI, as symbols of a more just, equitable and less West-toxicated political order. Today's episode features Sher Ali Tehreen and Salman Said talking to Sheila Khan on the interrogation of the concepts of liberalism, populism and secularism in relation to the current political crisis that has gripped Pakistan. Let's listen in.
Assalamu alaikum, hello, and Eid Mubarak to our listeners at Radio Reorient. I'm Sheila Khan, and today I'll be hosting the second part in our podcast series on the political struggle in Pakistan. As in the last episode, I'll be in conversation with Professor Salman Said.
Assalamu alaikum, everyone, and Eid Mubarak.
And Dr. Sher Ali Tehreen.
Assalamu alaikum, Eid Mubarak, hello to all.
And we will continue to interrogate aspects of the struggle that tend to be obscured in Orientalist analyses, as well as in popular commentary that also falls under their shadow. Furthermore, as scholars of the Islamicate, we are especially wary of falling into the trap of methodological nationalism, and thus are keen to explore the resonance of the struggle in the wider Islamosphere. Indeed, it is not far-fetched to say that the various dimensions of the struggle in Pakistan and the discourses in which these are framed are in many ways emblematic of ummatic struggles for autonomy around the world. So to recap briefly on the struggle, Pakistan is currently a de facto military dictatorship. The current regime turns on an overriding objective, the elimination of the former PM Imran Khan from politics and the neutering of his party, the PTI. In pursuit of its objectives, it continues to wage a reign of terror against its people, trampling over legal safeguards and fundamental rights, and in the process, resorting to unabashed criminality. Thousands, including women workers and supporters of the PTI, are detained in prison, kept in appalling condition, subjected to various forms of abuse, denied medical help, and rearrested upon being granted bail. In other instances, the regime threatens to or actually kidnaps family members, wives, children, and elders if it cannot abduct workers who are either in hiding or they resort to coercing detainees to leave the PTI. It is now instituting a system of military courts to try civilians whom it cannot hope to convict in a civilian justice system that allows even a minimally fair trial. The regime's brutality has met with silence from the so-called international liberal democratic community, gaslighting or denial from obliging media outlets, and fulsome approval from the domestic multi-party coalition that represents its civilian front and includes secular liberals as well as religious groups. So let's begin this podcast by talking about the ways in which this convergence of interests may prompt us to rethink our understandings of religion and secularity in Pakistan. So should we begin with you, Dr. Tehreen?
Sure, Assalamu alaikum. Thank you so much, Shella, for this introduction and for this opportunity. You know, before I take on the question of religion and secularism, I just want to clarify for our listeners the point of what we're doing here. These conversations are not about supporting a particular political party, the PTI in this instance. This is not an argument for, you know, voting for Imran or for the PTI. So it's not some kind of a partisan political podcast. I just want to clarify that. We are interested primarily in examining some framings of the current political turmoil and situation in Pakistan that are not being highlighted either in the mainstream media or in academic scholarly conversations on this current unfolding situation. And we want to do that as scholars of post-Orientalist scholars of the Islamic age on a particular political figure whose political vision does include and does center discourses on Islam and a vision of the political which draws on resources from the Islamic tradition. And that we believe is critical to the kinds of exaggerated critiques, to the kinds of caricatures that are often attached to him, again, in the mainstream media, among liberal fundamentalists in Pakistan, and sometimes even among some academics who otherwise do sophisticated work. So we are trying to present an alternate framing of the current political situation. And this is not some kind of an endorsement of any particular political party or figure. So I just wanted to really clarify that from the beginning. So yeah, I think this whole discussion on religion and secularism is very crucial to this whole conversation. And this whole argument, which by now is quite familiar to scholars of religion, anthropology, in the Western Academy, that religion and secularism ought not to be seen as binary opposites, but rather the secular is a form of power, a form of discourse that constantly regulates and manages and controls what we mean by good religion. And what good religion oftentimes represents is religion that is most amenable to the desires of colonialism and more recently American imperialism, and that presents a vision of good religion that is closest to a more familiar Protestant notion of religion, which is primarily to do with inner piety, not so much to do with practice. And ultimately, the main goal of this whole secular discourse is to present religion and especially Islam as the other, as the opposite of politics. And this notion that if religion and religious discourse and religious actors or even political actors who draw on religious resources for their political vision, if they're not properly contained and managed, that will always result in religious excess, which will always result in violence. So at the heart of this whole discourse is the binary between violence and politics, whereby religion as a form of life and discourse, if not contained, will overstep its boundaries and result in violence, whereas the political is the sphere of rationality, calculated thinking, that is the opposite of religion and the marker of an enlightened subject in society. This kind of a framing, this kind of a binary opposition is something that Imran Khan willingly or maybe unwittingly frustrates in many of his political positions and discourses. And that, I think, has a lot to do with the kind of Western silence on the current moment in Pakistan. I mean, if the same thing had been happening to a self-avowedly secular political party, I'm sure there would have been many more programs on this in places like Democracy Now and even other channels. A lot more hue and cry would have come from different quarters within Pakistan and elsewhere. And I just want to give a couple of examples, and then Salman, of course, can speak about this in more sophisticated ways. And I would have said this even if Salman was not here, that, and I always recommend this to other people wanting to understand better this whole argument about secularism as a form of power that constantly regulates religion, that the chapter on secularism in Salman's Recalling the Caliphate, I think, is one of the most accessible and effective articulation of this argument. So I would highly recommend that chapter in that book. But I just want to give a couple of examples very, very briefly. Most recently, we saw this document leaked by the military about how they want to frame and cast Imran Khan. And it's a very poorly written document, but the underlying argument that they try to make is that this is some kind of a religious extremist who needs to be contained. So we see even the military, drawing on a certain global discourse of good religion and what is the threatening form of religion in order to discount the political productivity of Imran as a figure. We saw, the current defense minister, Khwaja Asif, back when Imran was in power, he goes to Washington, D.C. or New York at one of these think tanks and basically argues that, look, we are the good kind of liberals that you can talk to, that you can engage with. And the Imran and his party is the religious fundamentalist. So the brown person basically pleading to white power I am the innocuous, benign liberal. Whereas PMLN, of course, has a whole record where that even the espousal of liberalism would be problematic there. Miftah Ismail, who was the former finance minister, when he goes to Washington, D.C., he says that, you know, Imran Khan was the one who kept saying Amr bil Ma'ruf wa Nahi anil Munkar as his fight against corruption, you know, enjoining the normative and forbidding the bad or the taboo. And he said, this is the same slogan that the Taliban used to use. And look, Imran Khan, this guy, you know, our opposition is using that to frame us as some kind of heretics. Again, espousing the sympathies of the white subject while engaging in this discourse of, you know, liberal secularism. Or more recently, Hussein Haqqani goes on Christiane Amanpour and says that, oh, Imran Khan is a reincarnation of Khomeini and wants to be Khomeini. Again, trying to activate this underlying racist, liberal, secular desire to tame, to control, to moderate Muslim subjects so that they don't exceed into violence. The power of this discourse of liberal secularism as the other of Islam is at the heart of the silence, the caricatures, the misrepresentations, and the dehumanization of Imran Khan as a political actor. Because there is a lot of it, a lot of his discourse and his political positions really disrupt this kind of a neat vision of the world. So that, I think, is something that needs to be highlighted.
Sure, thank you very much. Would you like to come in, Professor Sayed?
Well, firstly, I just want to agree with what Sherry said, but I want to pick up two things, and I think he started off with this. We have to understand the focus on Imran Khan and PTI as more of a focus, not just on the specifics and the empirical reference of Imran Khan and the PTI, but more importantly, about what it represents. I think the PTI and Imran Khan now especially represent more than perhaps what they've delivered. And I think it's really what they represent is the possibility of a deep-seated reform, a series of reforms that has the potential to make Pakistan far more attuned with its people and what their desires and wishes may be. And this may be both at the level of socioeconomic well-being, it may be the level of good practical good governance, but I think there's also an ideological component which brings all of these elements together. And in a sense, it makes the idea of Pakistan more central and links up where the population is in relation to that ideal. So I think it's important to recognize that the threat that Imran Khan represents at this moment is a threat to the possibility of business as usual. And in fact, that has always been his threat, that whether he's willingly or unwittingly or however, without necessarily complicatedly or in a way of even cogently, he has that possibility of inscribing a different kind of Pakistan. And that is what is driving them, rather than just the PTI and Imran Khan. And many of the Pakistani observers and commentators on the political scene there cannot address two points. So they carry on talking about how this is exaggerated, the opposition to Imran Khan, although it's not really problematic, it's more, it's been done before. What they don't understand is that what Imran Khan has managed to achieve is build a frontier between the people and the establishment, a frontier which rearranges and dissolves the dichotomies by which Pakistan has been read and practiced. And what I mean by this is that if you try and see how Pakistan has been understood, both by academics, intellectuals, but also policy practitioners, it's been found by a series of dichotomies. Sher Ali talked about the one between religion and violence, between violence and secularism, but there is the one more, even a more conventional one, between civilian rule and military rule. Like, these are two different kinds of entities, and have and they fall back, because civilian rule will always turn out to be positive, military rule will always be negative, and they are two oppositional points. What has happened now, or between the madrasa and the mullahs and the military, as all of these dichotomies have become rearranged around this frontier between the position represented by Imran Khan as a kind of a metaphor for the popular will, and those who are entrenched in power, in various institutions, among various dynastic families, within sort of particular sectors of the economy, media, all of those are basically in opposition to this idea of the popular will. And that is what is a real danger with Imran Khan, that his level of support, as manifested by even the elections that have happened since his disposition, make it very, very difficult even to rig the elections. So this, what we're seeing now, is a kind of a dissolution of those conventional dichotomies and differences between military and civilian rule, between between certain political parties and other political parties, around a frontier which divides those who are basically for the status quo against the people who want something better now. And that, I think, is the real, real threat of that. And I think part of that is really recognizing that the way that Pakistan has always been understood has been locked in this kind of orientalist discourse, in which these kinds of dichotomies have been allowed to rule supreme over our understanding of what is going on. And it is those, the dissolution of those dichotomies, which both poses an analytical and a political challenge to the understanding of the current situation. The people who oppose Imran Khan are committed to the fact that they are in normalizing a particular kind of order. They've always been a sense of entitlement, and they have never seen themselves as being part of this overarching establishment, because they thought the differences between those who wore uniforms and those who didn't were the main cleavage in Pakistani politics. What has happened now is that Imran Khan is going to demonstrate that, in fact, the civilian and the military are not military leadership, especially in the civilian, represented through these dynastic parties and their hangers-on, are not in opposition to each other. They're not necessarily too distinct. They are part of the same ensemble that has ruled Pakistan, at least since, probably from since 70 years, but certainly in different configurations for a very long time. And I think that belief that this way of governing can carry on, I think, is being tested. And that, I think, is a real, real challenge. And that's why the struggle has reached these kind of proportions, that there doesn't seem to be a way around this. And it's become an existential struggle for the prevailing ruling order.
So there's something of an irony here. I think what you're both saying is that this convergence of interests has effectively eroded the boundary, if there were indeed one, between religion and secularism, at least in Pakistan's context. And that's been a boundary that secular liberals have always been at pains to reinforce. And Dr. Thareen's reference to the document that the military has produced suggests that actually they are trying to now reinforce the boundary, which is effectively eroding as this crisis plays out. Am I correct in putting it this way?
I think
it's like we it almost seems as if the there is a need to keep that boundary intact. And yet, the way this crisis has played out, the way it's brought together interests whom you would normally see or think of as being oppositional or at least in collision, it's like, you know, the sort of the guardians, the custodians of that boundary are saying, no, well, actually, we need to keep this intact. So, you know, the military goes about saying, well, Imran Khan is the fundamentalist, not Fazlur Rahman. He's the fundamentalist that we need to be wary of.
I think what's happening is this, that way of reading the situation, current situation in Pakistan, through these various kind of microscopic maneuvers misses the kind of broader point. I think you're absolutely right, but I think it's always been the case. I think what has happened in Pakistan now is that you're seeing a proper political struggle. And that means that it is being determined by antagonisms. And those antagonisms and those conflicts are saturating all sorts of social relations, and they're saturating all kinds of established and sedimented views of understanding things. So it shouldn't surprise us that the West toxicated can embrace Fazlur Rahman and not see the fact this is a contradiction, when on another occasion they would see it as something oppositional, they reject all of that. The regime and its supporters will do everything in their power, make any alliances, oppose anyone, to do anything to maintain that hold in power. And therefore, the identity of those positions is no longer governed by any previous logic. It is governed by this frontier that has been established between the people of Pakistan and the rulers of Pakistan. And that is what has really the real struggle is about. And in that category, the West toxicated, the very kind of Salafists, or the very kind of regime, the regime mullahs, all of them, the leading elements of the civil service, the police, all of them will arrange themselves according to that frontier now. And that is the challenge. So this is why you have in Pakistan for the first time a serious number of senior military figures breaking ranks to a limited extent, but still quite significant in the context of Pakistan, about what is happening here. There doesn't seem to be any appetite or even a constituency in favor of a more overt military rule in the country. There is no kind of joy that the military will come and clear up the situation, which has been so damaged, etc. All of those narratives have dissolved, and the clear frontier now is between the people of Pakistan and those who are basically trying to govern them despotically in a direct. And that, I think, is a real issue now.
Yeah, I think this is a very important point when we're talking about the whole encounter of religion and secularism, that the point of this is not to say that some actors are indeed religious and others are indeed secular. But the point being, notice the power and attraction of a certain set of desires which are rooted in discourses of colonialism and more recently neo imperialism, whereby framing particular actors as potentially dangerous brings you global dividends. And I think that is at the heart of that military document, that they're really trying to respond to and oblige to a global terrain of discourse, whereby framing a particular actor as potentially extremist, as potentially, excessive in his religious rhetoric or program, will lead to that actor's global undermining of politics. So I think that is a very crucial point to keep in mind. That in some ways really explains the kind of attempts by different set of actors who are marked as religious, who are marked as a military, or marked as self-avowed liberal seculars, to draw on this global allure of framing religion in this kind of a fashion.
Shirley, if you mind, I want to come in at that point. I think it's very, very important to understand exactly what you're saying, that there is there is this framing which appeals to the kind of Islamophobic temper of the times, right, in a sense that you describe anything as exhibiting an exorbitant Muslimness, then becomes a way of eliciting support from the so-called international community, and not just its liberal branches, but you can see from other elements, other powers, for example, to the east or the north, etc. However, I also think we shouldn't think of this as simply an instrumental logic. The reason why the regime is framing it this way is not simply because that's how they think they will get support from what they're doing. I actually believe that the regime also thinks like that. I think all of those on the other side of that frontier also endorse and internalize this view of understanding the Islamicate or the exaggerated sense of a Muslimness which is autonomous as being problematic, as being challenging, as being disruptive in all kinds of different ways. So I would just want to make sure that we don't give the impression that this is simply an instrumental move. There's always a degree of calculation, but it is actually the way that this discourse of the regime structures itself. It is, and this is why I think this is what it has a very clear alignment with what I, you know, have described on many occasions as Kemalism. And Kemalism has always been predicated on the idea that for any Muslim society, however you want to put it, for any Islamic society, to prosper, to project itself into the future, it must somehow eradicate, eliminate, marginalize Islamicate traces. In other words, it imitates and internalizes the Orientalist opposition between modernity and the Islam and the Islamicate, and therefore builds the idea that for it to progress, it needs to get rid of or control these expressions of Muslimness, to control Islam. And that tension, which has been running for the last 100 years in most, if not all, Muslim communities, is being played out here, where you have sections of the population who have internalized that Orientalism. And for them, Islam isn't the future, it is the past. And therefore, if they are to have a future, they must de-Islamicize themselves in some shape, way, or form. Yeah. And that de-Islamicization can be ultra-secularist, like the the historically regimes of Mustafa Kemal or Reza Khan in Iran, or like the communists or even the colonial rulers. Or they can be more kind of varied, where you have an official formulation for the expression of Muslimness, which, for example, doesn't impinge upon social, economic questions, which doesn't impinge upon great things beyond the current architecture of the world system. So I think it would be important to bear this in mind, that this is not an instrumental move. These are as much true believers as anyone else.
Yeah, I know we need to move to other themes, but very briefly, I just want to build on this and make two very brief comments on this whole theme. I think the whole question of Orientalism is perhaps very useful as a frame to address this conundrum that we often hear about in this case, that how is it that this one person is attracting visceral critiques from such varied actors, ranging from Fazlur Rahman of JUIF to a moron like Pervez Hoodboy. What explains that? And I think Orientalism in some ways is a useful framing for that, because ultimately what Orientalism is the exoticization or the dehumanization of the Orient, the East, to establish the superiority of the West. So in this case, we see, for example, this very common narrative around Imran, the playboy turned religious fundamentalist, right? This whole narrative that we see very often, even amongst academics. He used to be a playboy, and then he had a conversion and became a religious fundamentalist. The problem with that is a few-fold. One is that this whole discourse of playboy was attached to him in the 70s and early 80s by the British press, in the context of him being a formidable cricket player who was really causing a lot of problems for the English batsman with his fast bowling. So to really undermine the professionalism of a brown athlete, this was this whole idea that he's really the playboy, he's a licentious person, etc. And as if conversion just happens overnight. And if you read his book, and I think I've mentioned this in an earlier conversation we've had, Shella, that when you read his book, he in fact mentions that he began to think more carefully about Islam, in fact, through his experiences on the cricket field, when he saw the contingencies of life. Why is it that some balls hit the wicket, some balls don't, some balls go over the rope and some don't? So he started thinking about this whole idea of contingency that led him then to, you know, eventually find his Sufi peer, Mia Bashir, and so on and so forth. So there is that discourse. But on the other hand, there is also that discourse that why does he talk about Riyasat-e-Madina? He's being too fundamentalist about it. Or the one that has really, really upset secular liberals in Pakistan is the whole reform that he tried to bring about in the education system. That the education system of the country should not be in the form of this kind of a tripartite division between private schools, Urdu medium public schools, and then the madrasas. But there has to be some kind of confluence between these three streams of society, and that this is a colonial legacy that we have to confront. Now, you could be critical of aspects of that education policy, but this really, really upset people. How dare you bring us on the same plane as the madrasas and the Urdu medium public schools, which really shows the intersection of class and secularity as well. And the final point I want to make on this question of violence and politics is that if you notice his discourse on Islamophobia, his main argument was that when you use the category of Islamic extremism and you reduce violence or any kind of freedom movement like that in Kashmir or in Palestine to religious motivations, what that basically does is that it delegitimizes the political purchase, the political horizons and of these freedom struggles. Why do we not call the Tamil Tigers as Hindu violence? Why is this kind of a idea of violence and Islamic violence only appended to Muslim actors? Because it's part of this larger secular discourse that if this kind of violence comes from non-state Muslim actors, it is terrorism, it is violence. But when the state engages in much more brutal forms of violence, the Israeli state, the Indian state, and now, of course, the Pakistani state as well, that somehow is okay because that's part of the whole frame of a liberal political order. So the way in which he's disrupted this whole binary between, you know, legitimate state violence and non-legitimate religious violence is something that does not sit well with people within the country and with the global powers. And that, I think, has a lot to do with why he was deposed and the resistance that we see against him and the silence on the kind of brutal atrocities that are happening to him and his party right now. So I think the whole framing of Orientalism and liberal secular discourse is very useful to even think about the current political moment and unfoldings.
Yeah, sure. I wonder if you agree whether there's a real sense of precarity and insecurity in the kind of discourses that are coming out, both from the military and from their liberal secular supporters. Because again, going back to the whole question of, you know, dividing lines and binaries, if liberals can no longer confidently assert themselves or their own position in opposition to Islam or to religion, then what do they actually stand for? And that's why I remarked earlier that it does sound as if the military is trying to reinforce that binary, because it is crucial to the self-definition of several groups. And that's not to say that it's instrumental, it's existential. I don't know whether you share the sense of that, sort of beneath all this violence that's being perpetrated against the Pakistani people, the abductions, torture, disappearances, so on and so forth, incarceration. Do you see precarity and insecurity, or do you see confidence? What do you both see?
I think it's a universal truth, if there are universal truths in political science, that the use of violence by any regime always indicates a vulnerability. And that has been the case historically from Stalin, the French Revolution, whatever you want to say, because if you are fully established, then the violence is actually systematized and it doesn't appear. So I think there is that. I also think that it's worth thinking about similar situations where we've seen similar coalitions in Turkey or in Egypt or in Tunisia. In all of them, they've had to been uses of mass violence to try and attempt to thwart that articulation between popular will and the Islamic State. And in some places, this has been successfully done, but it's required a great deal of violence. In other places, for example, in Turkey, that was defeated by popular mobilization, etc. So I think there is a precariousness to it, because ultimately there's also a sense in which the project that these regimes and these governments have, there's a failure of government. They don't actually know what to do. There is no sense in which there is, they can point to anything that they will achieve. And I think this goes back to the one of the abiding romances of the Liberal Democrats and the less intoxicated in Pakistan and other parts of the world, Muslim lands, has been that, you know, if we get rid of absolutist rule in the form of military, in terms of military rule, we will then have democracy, and democracy itself will solve all our problems and will actually bring us forward. What you have often in these cases is not a democratization, because in the Islamic State, there can be no democratization which doesn't take into account the Muslimness of the population. So you can't have a democratization which doesn't mean a somehow a mobilization of the Islamic State vocabulary to do work, to do good work. So given that, I think you have a situation in which the idea that in Pakistan, you know, since Musharraf's time, we've had rule by two, by a number of political parties, basically two, who have not necessarily demonstrated a delivery in a fundamental sense. So they haven't even been able to be successful in their own terms. And I think this is, again, shows that the idea that these two, the dichotomies between govern Pakistan could deliver the future of Pakistan has not been demonstrated.
Yeah, and I think on the question of the military, of course, the military has been very adept at and very willing to instrumentally use quote-unquote religious actors like the TLP in Tehreek-e-Labbaik, etc., for mobilization against its political enemies. So again, the point here is not to make some kind of a clear-cut distinction between the religious subject and the secular subject. But, you know, if you see things like the discourse of Pervez Musharraf around enlightened moderation, I mean, that is as liberal fundamentalist as it gets, this whole idea that, you know, you moderate religion and tame it so that it's amenable to a global order of what is good Islam. Or more recently, in this whole regime change operation, you found this General Bajwa basically applauding the US and its values and condemning, you know, Russia just a few days before the vote of no confidence happened, clearly trying to attract this kind of a global approval from empire. So I think that that whole discourse of, and oftentimes it's an unwitting pressure that we ought to oblige and we ought to be seen comparable to a global order of what is good religion is very central to these kinds of political maneuvers that we see on the ground.
So are we right to think that this crisis marks the death knell for the so-called sort of, you know, sympathy or compatibility between liberalism and democracy?
I think we should be very cautious writing death knells for anyone. We do not know. I think the issue is there's a matter of contingency. I think what we can say is there is a possibility for a different kind of arrangement, but what will happen really depends on how very contingent set of circumstances are worked out in the struggle that is ongoing right now in Pakistan and no doubt elsewhere. But I do think it is worth bearing this in mind, that certainly it is clear that without an opening for Muslimness in these societies, it is very, very difficult to see anything but a restoration of some kind of absolutist rule. Whether it has counterfeit elections or not is a matter of detail. So I think the other thing I would say to you is that the liberal democratic regimes have also lost a lot of their allure and luster, as they have become much more undermined by the revelations, which cannot be hidden, of the kind of xenophobia and racism and Islamophobia specifically, that they're quite comfortable with. So, you know, you see many of these regimes, these countries who were established, consolidated liberal democracies, inching away from universal human rights, inching away from societies proclaiming a degree of equality, being hollowed out by neoliberal logic. And I think this is one of the biggest challenges, the kind of global hegemony of neoliberalism, not just in terms of economic management, but epistemological focus on individuals, has reduced the space for alternatives. And much of that kind of disengagement, which is a global phenomenon between the political elite and these kind of various popular attempts to unsettle that, are a reflection of the inability of the neoliberal hegemony to recognize its failure and its disintegration. Mm-hmm. So we are in a situation of a zombie neoliberalism.
Yeah. And Shailen and Salman, I think this point is very critical to at least make the claim that the events of the last 14 months have dealt a death to this whole claim that the PDM was somehow, you know, standing for some kind of democracy, which is something that we saw repeatedly, even in places like Democracy Now, which is, you know, the favorite channel of left radicals. And if you really want to be, you know, check all the right boxes, that's what you watch. And they kept on producing these shows on Pakistan when clearly they didn't have a good internship program of someone actually researching, valorizing these people like Maryam Nawaz and Bilawal Bhutto as champions of democracy who were fighting against this, you know, military installed religious fundamentalist, replaying all the Oriental stereotypes, and at the same time doing a very poor job of communicating what was actually going on, happening on the ground, and which informed then the thought of people around the world and this kind of caricature that happened. That also explains why currently how many opinion pieces are being written in places like Dawn, etc., which are really taking account of these complexities and kind of degree of violence that is being done. So this erasure, I think, has a lot to do with the global allure and hegemony. So oftentimes, you know, the counter argument that people present is that, oh, it's the religious actors in Pakistan who really have street power, who can block roads, etc. Secular liberals already are a beleaguered group, they're already under siege, and why are we engaging in this kind of hammering of liberal secularism? Well, see the global power of the right kind of secular discourse. That's how you get op-eds published in New York Times, at The Guardian, and Dawn. This, the broader discourse of being the right kind of brown Muslim, which is amenable to a liberal secular vision of what is good religion, is absolutely central to the kind of erasure that we are seeing right now. Or if not erasure, then these kinds of narratives like, oh, this is just a spat between former lovers, the military and the PTI, which basically is a very insidious kind of framing, because all that it does is it completely empties any kind of productive politics which is coming out of the situation and really tries to discredit Imran or PTI as actors who might challenge the hegemony and the violence of the military and the larger global order of secularity that it is a part of. And there is much in his discourse recently that suggests that this is a very serious challenge, and hence they are using all this kind of brute violence. If he was not a challenge, then why would this kind of violence and the degree to it be expended? Clearly, it is a symptom of both the fragility of the state and its anxiety and fear regarding an actor who is challenging their authority and their hegemony.
I mean, I would argue that liberals have squandered their monopoly on democracy, because they were really the flag bearers of democracy, of the rule of law, of constitutionalism. And what I find deeply ironic is that having squandered stranglehold, if you like, on democracy, they refer to Imran Khan. I mean, they refer to Imran Khan in a sort of depreciating way as a populist. So Imran Khan's populism is seen as an inferior, you know, kind, or even a completely ersatz or fake version of democracy. I don't know if either of you would like to sort of finish off this podcast with a quick comment on that.
Well, I'm not sure if it's a quick thing, because I think the argument about populism is vexed. I mean, firstly, there is a sense in which the neoliberal hegemony represents challenges to it as being populist as a way of delegitimating them. Because, and in a sense that populism has always been used to argue for situations which appear to have democratic credentials, but are not articulated with liberalism. So that's always been a problem. I think the way I would suggest that we understand populism as simply a, not necessarily an ideology, but simply a form and approach of engaging with the political, in which there is a division which is made between a ruling oligarchy and the people. And therefore, most forms of transformational politics will always have that populist moment in them. What makes the populist moment so critical right now is the, as I've said before, is the neoliberal hegemony, which forecloses any kind of social democratic or any leftist alternative. Populism by itself doesn't have a ideology. It doesn't have a particular content. It is about constituting political identities in a particular way. And that is why, for example, you can see this kind of disarticulation even in the PTI's agenda, where they want to talk about Medina, Riyasat al-Madina, but they also want to talk about healthcare. And then, you know, you have these very literalistically minded, less toxicated commentators unable to compete. Well, how can you talk about Riyasat al-Madina and healthcare? Well, yes, you can, because that's what articulation is about. That to have that Riyasat al-Madina means having a welfare state. It means having access to healthcare for a large number of the population which do not have that. So I think we have to understand this thing about populism as just another weapon in the armory of trying to delegitimize what the Imran Khan's position is.
Absolutely.
To make those comparisons with people like Trump and Putin, etc., and Erdogan. But again, not looking at the content, that you may have populist leaders or populism of the left, you may have populism of the right, you may have a populism which is xenophobic, you may have a populism which is absolutely xenophilic. So it is not, it doesn't tell us very much. All it tells us is that you're completely enmeshed in the liberal democratic narrative of itself and determining what is legitimate form of politics and what is not. And I think part of the decolonial moment, part of the decolonization imperative, must be to decolonize the very idea that the West can determine what shape and what approach to take towards politics itself.
Shala, you must have the last word. But very briefly, I think Salman is absolutely right. And I just want to make a very quick point about the very first question you asked about secularism. There can be no vision and possibility of a decolonial politics that does not involve a critique of secularism as the opposite of religion. Because this whole framing of secularism and secular power as the opposite of religion and Islam is foundational to the logic of colonialism and more recently imperialism. So you can, as much of a radical as you might think, but unless your thinking has a substantive critique of secular power, there can be no possibility of decolonial politics. And that's why this is so crucial. Coming to populism, I think populism and the framing of Imran as a populist and his followers as cult followers, I think these have been the two most dominant strands and categories of dismissal and pathological categories that have been used to dismiss his politics. So when you have one category, populism, which is being equally applied to actors that are so vast in range as Imran and Modi and Erdogan and Putin and so on, clearly something is problematic with that kind of category, and clearly there is some serious intellectual shallowness that is happening here. This is what I would call the Pankaj Mishra, you know, model of analysis, where you just take one phenomenon, bring five actors together, and then this category explains everything about them. As Salman mentioned, critical or the most common framing is that Imran is Pakistan's Trump. As Salman mentioned, critical to Trump's popularity during his election campaign while he was in power as well was xenophobia and active hate against ethnic minorities. That is not central to Imran Khan's politics. You could say that his politics reviles corrupt politicians. There are contradictions to that. But it really does not is comparable to Trump's politics. If anything, Trump, of course, is someone as a real estate agent who's made all his money through real estate and is framing his daughter as his political successor. So if any comparison has to be made, it should be between Trump and Nawaz Sharif. In fact, that's much more substantive. I think we ought to be really, really cautious about, and this whole idea of cult following, right? This has been the kind of framing, even by academics, you know, otherwise sophisticated academics, which basically makes the point that all these millions of people, including women, children, differently abled, elderly, and thousands who come to his rallies, who support him, are basically under some kind of influence of this cult figure who has given them this some kind of a drug in which they are enchanted by this figure, whereby I think a more apt analysis would be of his whole discourse of Hakiki Azadi or true, freedom, is that in a country, as I mentioned in a recent op-ed I wrote, that in a country where there is this predominant sensibility that ultimately decisions of politics are taken elsewhere, whether that is the political elite, the military elite, or American empire, here you have the articulation of some hint of sovereign agency and power, which is very attractive to vast segments of the population across different ethnicities, across different provinces. And you can be critical of many aspects of his politics. Again, to punctuate a point we made earlier in our podcast, our point is not that every criticism of Imran is somehow problematic or is a symptom of Imranophobia, but these kinds of shallow framings of populism and cult following and the playboy turned fundamentalist or a lover spat between the military and PTI, these are not very helpful and productive framings to analyze and to think about and then really offer some kind of alternate political vision in regards to the current moment.
Yes, I mean, again, I think more ironies, because if there is an individual or an institution that aspires to cult status in this entire mess, it is not Imran Khan. And I think we all know what it is without having to spell it out. There's an institution which considers itself to be the custodian of the nation, the guardian of its future, unaccountable, unimpeachable, etc. But I think what this discussion has gone to show, and I mean, obviously we could go on talking for much longer, and we will, inshallah, in future podcasts, is that the entire discourse that is propping up this regime is really bankrupt. Once you scratch the surface, you realize how shallow it is, how ill-informed it is, and how ignorant it is. So really, there is very little chance of this regime building up a hegemony. It may try to rule through outright, you know, what we know as dominance through the exercise of brute force, but it can never construct a hegemonic narrative, at least not for anybody who isn't entirely, you know, ignorant or gullible. So I think that is something to think about until our next podcast anyway. But anyway, thank you again so much for your time. It's always a pleasure. And no doubt we will carry on dissecting the struggle for Pakistan. And thank you to our listeners.
Thank you, Shaila. Thank you, Salman.
Thank you. Thank you, Shirley. Thank you, Shaila.
This has been an episode of Radio Reorient, brought to you by Network Reorient, part of the Critical Muslim Studies Project. Your host has been Hiza Mir, and the episode has been sound engineered by Zubair Vakil. Thank you for tuning in. Have a listen to our other episodes, and please leave a like and a rating.